techniques. For computing cohomology. So I've decided to, my initial plan was to go into some kind of more abstract mathematical techniques, like exact sequences, but I think I've decided that's a little too abstract for the purposes of this course, and that we can get by with more elementary techniques. And I want to give a proof, or at least sketch a proof, of the hairy ball theorem. Which, once we know a little bit about how to compute cohomology, is actually not that hard. At least in special cases. Where am I? Let's get my notes. So the first theorem this is called Poincaré duality. If M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold without boundary, and which is also closed, meaning if you know more points at topology than we discussed, it's compact, or it's a closed and bounded subset of Rk. Then, I also want to assume that it's connected. Meaning there's only one component, so we can't divide it into two pieces that don't touch. And firstly, the dimension, the kth cohomology group of M, is equal to the dimension of the n minus kth cohomology of M. So this is a slightly strange looking statement. This somehow measures k-dimensional submanifolds, like how many there are that can't be contracted to a point. This is the same. This measures n minus k-dimensional submanifolds. And the result is that the dimensions are the same. Kind of tricky to give a solid geometric intuition for this, but the way you should think about it is any n minus k-dimensional manifold will generically intersect a k-dimensional manifold in some number of points. So by counting those points, that gives a pairing between these two sets. And that pairing, perfect pairing, so that the dimensions are the same. So, as I said, that was a vague statement. It's a little tricky to really get your hands on. So we will just use this as a black box for now to allow us to compute cohomology. So in particular, since and it's connected, well, the dimension of page zero, remember, that's just given by functions which are constant. Since M is connected, there's only one, function one. This is dimension one. So that means that the dimension of the top cohomology group is also one. So a second part of the same kind of package is if M is not orientable, but this satisfies the other conditions, then the dimension of the top cohomology group is zero.
Is it the homology group that is R or the dimension?
Ah, sorry. Thank you. Okay, so let's take this as a black box for now. Not get into too much detail, and we're going to use this to get some constraints on the cohomology groups. So the other result we have concerns the Euler characteristic. If M is a manifold, we say the Euler characteristic of M is it's the alternating sum of the dimensions of the cohomology group. So this is an integer. So it's some measure of the complexity of M. And the reason for introducing it is that the Euler characteristic behaves in a really nice way when you cut your manifold up into pieces. The next theorem is if a manifold is U union V, where U and V are open, then the Euler characteristic of M is the Euler characteristic of U plus the Euler characteristic of V minus the Euler characteristic of the intersection. So this is a formula that might be familiar from combinatorics, kind of inclusion exclusion type formula. So the things we've said so far are going to be enough to compute the cohomology groups of any manifold of dimension 2. And this result, this is kind of a consequence of a more complicated result. Showing the cohomology of M is built from the cohomology of these pieces. Okay, any questions?
Is there an intuition for like the sum being alternating rather than like a normal sum?
Well, if it wasn't, I mean,
the other ones wouldn't hold because the theorem is based on this definition, but
yeah.
I wonder how he thought about this definition.
Well, Euler thought about this in a different way. I mean, so we'll get to this in a minute. So what Euler was thinking about was you build a sphere from polygons glued together, then the number of vertices minus edges plus faces is always 2. So this is something you can just check yourself by hand. And because in that definition there was an alternating sum already, it was natural to include it here. And this definition is built so that it matches Euler's original definition. Now, in Euler's original definition, the reason there was an alternating sum was, suppose I take a polygon, you want to get something which is independent of how you cut it up. Now, if I cut it up, we've added one edge and one face. So vertices minus edges plus faces stays the same. Here, the alternating nature is clear. Any other questions?
Is this statement following from the dimensions? The theorem has that the dimensions are same, but then here you said the whole cohomology is the same. Is it, means in this statement in particular?
So here, you mean you want to compare this one to this one?
Statements are, have you
missed it? I mean, there's only one vector space of dimension 1. So it's really the same. There's only one vector space of a given dimension.
I see.
But there's a more canonical version of this, which is that this vector space is canonically the dual to this vector space. So if you have given an element of here, there's no natural way to build an element of this guy. There's a natural way to pair them to get a number. So let's now compute the Euler characteristic of S2. And in a minute, I want to connect it to this combinatorial definition in a minute.
You were just speaking about vector spaces, and previously, we did write down dimensions, so I can see where we're talking about vector spaces, but previously I thought of R and so on as groups.
Right. You're absolutely right. So people normally use the word cohomology groups because they might want to think of singular cohomology, which is not a vector space because it's defined with integer coefficients. So for some reason, I've been using the word groups, which is traditional. But when we work in Durham cohomology, they are vector spaces because differential forms are a vector space. I can add them and I can multiply them by real numbers. And that structure descends to cohomology. In our definition of cohomology, everything was about linear maps the DRAM operator was a linear map. I was taking its kernel. Then I was quotienting by a linear subspace. So all the linear structure survives.
You go so far as to say it's a functor from topological spaces to vector spaces.
Exactly, yes. It's a contravariant functor. Let's draw my T-sphere. This coordinate here is x3. And this is x3 is 0. This is just the usual T-sphere embedded in R3. So I want that U be the set of vectors in the T-sphere, where x3 is bigger than minus epsilon. Epsilon is some small number. And V be the same thing. Where x3 is less than minus, less than plus epsilon. So in pictures, this region here is U, whereas this region here is V. So as you can see, U is a disk. And also V is a disk. Whereas U intersection V is an annulus. U intersection V looks like this. Like a ring. So according to our formula, we want need to figure out the Euler characteristic of these three pieces and put them together to get the Euler characteristic of S2. So how do we do this? Well, we're going to rely on one more piece of information, which we've mentioned last time, which is that cohomology doesn't change if I replace a space by something homotopy equivalent. So from the point of view of topology, a disk is really the same as a point. So U is homotopy equivalent to a point. So the only cohomology of a point is OR, and the other cohomology vanishes. So the Euler characteristic of U is 1. Similarly, the Euler characteristic of V is 1. On the other hand, U intersection V, I look at this central circle, you can see that you can just squish it down to the central circle. So from the point of view of topology, there's really no difference between U intersection V and this circle in the middle. This is homotopy equivalent to a circle. We already saw, just by computing it, that H0 of S1 is OR, and H1 of S1 is also OR, so that the Euler characteristic of a circle vanishes. So we figured out that the Euler characteristic S2 is chi of U plus chi of V minus chi of U intersection V is 1 plus 1 minus 0 equals 2. This is good because our answer agrees with what Euler said a long time ago. However, you might be concerned that our definition is not obviously the same as what Euler said. Euler said we should look at vertices minus edges plus faces. And that doesn't seem obviously the same as what we get from cohomology. So let's check that this is the same. Question? Okay. Suppose that sigma is a two-dimensional manifold built by gluing polygons together. And we'll let V, E, F be the numbers of vertices, edges, and faces. And then, lemma, the Euler characteristic of sigma is equal to B minus E plus A. So here's the proof. So here's step one. We let W inside of sigma be an open subset is a small neighborhood of the edges and vertices. Draw a picture. I might have this kind of thing. And then I want to look at a little neighborhood that I call this W. So the first step is to show, compute the Euler characteristic of W. First, we show that the Euler characteristic of W is equal to vertices minus edges. Remember, we've got rid of all the faces. So it makes sense it wouldn't know about the faces. So to see this, let W1 be a small neighborhood of the vertices. W2 be a small neighborhood of the interiors of the edges. Let me draw a picture up here. Yep. So that will be W1. Need those disks like that. Another color. Those pink guys. Or W2. So, pink. So for W1, I have a disk for each vertex. So the order characteristic of W1 is the number of vertices. The order characteristic of W2, I have a disk for each edge. So this is the number of edges. Whereas the order characteristic of W1 intersection W2, if you look at the picture, each edge intersects the disks at each end of it. When I look at the intersection, that shaded region there, pretty hard to see, I get twice the number of edges. So therefore, I of W is I W1 chi W2 minus chi W1 intersection W2, which is V minus E.
How are you defining an edge?
Say that again, sorry?
How are you defining an edge? Because the intersection doesn't contain any vertex, and I thought an edge goes between vertices.
Oh, I meant the interior of the edge.
That's enough.
Oh, see. I want to set it up so that these opens associated to the edges don't touch each other. So I don't want to allow those opens to include the vertex itself. I want them to end just a little bit over there. Make sense? Because if they touched each other, that would be bad. That would make things more complicated. I only want them to touch the disks surrounding each.
So part of an edge counts as an edge.
An edge counts as an edge. What do you mean? Is your concern with, like, what do I mean by this?
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that's best expressed in pictures. Like, I take, you know, once I've drawn a little ball around each vertex, then I want to say I'm missing some regions, which is the middle of the edge. So let's say it's better. This is a small neighborhood of the midpoint of each edge. Is that better?
I guess it's confusing. So you're saying the midpoint of edges, but because when you said like the interior of the edge, like basically the whole edge except for the vertices themselves?
Yes.
But now you're just considering small neighborhood of the midpoint of the edges, then maybe it's not like, it does not, there's no intersection, right?
You don't want to make it too small.
Yeah.
So maybe it might be even better if we wrote it in with some numbers. If this edge is of length 1, here you might have a circle of radius 1/3. You don't want it to be too big because you don't want them to touch each other. Also is radius 1/3. And here you want to have some kind of piece of this. These intersect at distance 1/3 from each end. So this thing would have width just a small bit greater than 1/3. So just like enough so that these guys cover everything, but not too much. You don't want them to be too big, because if it was too big, you might worry it might hit this other thing, and you don't want that to happen. I mean, the truth is, like, no matter how you set this up, you're going to get the same answer. I just wanted to choose a way of doing it so that the computation was easy. And if these opens touch those options, it might make the computation more complicated.
On that, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, this shows that the Euler characteristic is finitely additive.
Yes.
Is it countably additive? Can I have, if I decompose M into a countable number of open sets, would it be true that of disjoint open sets, the Euler characteristic of the manifold is just the sum?
That's tricky because it's a signed sum, convergence is going to be an issue. You'd also worry that
the convergence is from the topology on R. This is a function to R. I mean, it's a subset of R, but like, you can use the topology on R.
Let's do an example. You know, take the wheels. And then you could cut it up into an infinite number of intervals like this. And then you get pi of, you get something like sum n going from 0 to infinity, 1 minus sum infinity of 1. That seems tricky. Because you've countably many positive things. Each open and kind of many negative from the intersections of a pair of them. I worry that that's going to cause you problems.
Okay, so you're saying that by this definition, with the alternating sum, that that's going to cause you problems and not.
Well, I mean, it could be that the problem could arise if I took U to be a countable disjoint union of opens, then chi of U would be infinite. So I should have been more careful saying, let's assume that U is such that its Euler characteristic is cohomology groups are finite dimensional, then this is valid.
Does it make sense to have infinite type?
Infinite type?
Infinite type.
There certainly are manifolds where you would say they should have positive and negative Euler characteristic. But in those situations, the cohomology groups themselves are better behaved. For instance, if I took the plane, I've drawn this box, and I removed all of the integers, then H1 is infinite dimensional because there's a circle going around each point I remove. They're all independent. So this, you would say, the first cohomology group is indeed infinity. The Euler characteristic should be minus infinity. But you could also engineer situations where both H1 and H2 were infinite dimensional, and then you would have problems.
I see.
So in those situations, the cohomology group itself is better.
I see.
So let me just complete this argument. So now, if I take my surface, we write W as be a neighborhood of the edges and vertices. And we let U be the interior of the faces. So pi of W is V minus E, pi of U is F. What about the intersection? I'll draw a picture for that. This was a face. Now, W, I'm going to take a neighborhood of the boundary, and U is the interior. The U intersection W consists of an S1 of the homotopy for each face. Because I'm just left with this region here. And that has no Euler characteristic. The chi of U intersection W is 0. So we get a result. E plus F E. Oh, okay, so now, in principle, you guys can work out the Euler characteristic of any surface using this formula. Now, for instance, and we can apply this to compute the cohomology. Well, the Euler characteristic of S2 is 2. H0 of S2 is OR because it's connected. H2 of S2 also OR by Poincare duality. So H1 of S2, the dimension of this guy must be 0. Because these guys each contribute 1 to the Euler characteristic, 2, and we don't take anything away. So the intuition all circles in S2 are the boundary of something. If I take any kind of wiggly circle, if we take our intuitive idea that cohomology measures submanifolds, for those that are boundaries should be set to 0, this is saying that every circle is the boundary of a region, which should match your geometric intuition. Yeah.
H1 of S2, because it's counting all the one-dimensional manifolds contractible to a point. So therefore, you're mapping it, saying all circles on S2. And then how is the boundary thing coming in the intuition? Should be boundary of something.
Yeah, so, so if you remember from Stokes' theorem, a class in H1, mm-hmm. you can integrate it over a one-dimensional manifold. Uh-huh. And if that one-dimensional manifold is a boundary of something, that integral is 0. So classes in H1 should be thought intuitively as one-dimensional submanifolds, except that I only count those which aren't the boundary of them. Or better, there's an equivalence relation where two one-manifolds are equivalent if their union is the boundary of something.
Maybe explain how this might fail if you don't have an orientable surface.
So the part that's going to fail if you don't have an orientable surface is Poincare duality. So that in a non-orientable surface, the second cohomology group is 0. And the intuition for that is, you know, a cohomology class is something I integrate over an oriented region. So if I have a non-orientable surface, I mean, it doesn't make sense to integrate a second cohomology class over the whole region. You want a more explicit answer? We could explicitly look at the Klein bottle and see it as no cohomology, but I'm not sure if that would be super informative.
Yeah, maybe something to play around in home time.
Yeah.
Just because it seems very intuitive that if you can't find like a volume form or orientability, then yeah, you will end up getting some problem with the boundary. Right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, because I had a two form on the Klein bottle, it doesn't transform in the correct way to integrate because of the sign. So I wanted to spend the last few minutes of the class discussing a version of the hairy ball theorem. So, once I take a surface, I want to take a function on it. And suppose that sigma has a Riemannian metric. The hairy ball theorem concerns vector fields. It says if I have a vector field on the two-sphere, there must be at least two points in which it's zero. So we're going to look at a version of it which doesn't work for every vector field, but it works for a vector field which is the gradient of a function. So once I have this, I can take the set E, be the gradient of f, which in coordinates is this is a vector field.
Shouldn't it have any restriction on that?
There's no restriction? I want f to be generic. So it should certainly be smooth. But I'm going to make a stronger assumption in a second. That really means like a randomly chosen function. So then v is equal to zero at points p where the f, the xi, p equal to zero. So there's some points both partial derivatives of f vanish. These are called critical points. I'm sure you're familiar with this. You know, the study of critical points of a function is a pretty basic thing in physics. So the precise genericity assumption I'm going to make is that the Hessian matrix is non-degenerate. So if we assume the Hessian matrix is non-degenerate, there's really three possibilities. Firstly, E is a local maximum. So that F looks like x1 squared plus x2 squared, your P, and V, which looks like is a source. So here's P, and everything flows away from there. Secondly, P is a local minimum, and V is a sink. So P is a sink for V. Or thirdly, P is a saddle point. F looks like x1 squared minus x2 squared, and V is like thing. Okay, so those are the three possibilities. So what we're going to find is that we count these possibilities with sign, we'll get the Euler characteristic. The theorem is that the Euler characteristic of my surface is equal to the number of sinks plus the number of sources minus the number of saddles. So in particular, for the two-sphere, if my vector field is a gradient, this tells us there is at least 2 points at which my vector field must vanish, because the Euler characteristic. Any questions before I turn to the proof, which is actually not hard? Proof. With the correct sign conventions, you see the local minima are sinks. And more generally, we note F decreases along the flows of V. In particular, there are no periodic orbits. So I'm going to get a lot. We're going to cut sigma up into bases, edges, and vertices by bases are those x and sigma that flow to a sink. So each face really is a disk. So for each sink, there is one face.
Statement in the proof that you wrote, f decreases along the flows of v.
Did I get the sign wrong?
Uh-huh.
Did I get the sign wrong?
No. I just can't. Are we assuming that it is one of these three possibilities already, or something like that?
Well, no. We can just. That's true of any gradient flow, because.
Yeah.
You think about v applied to f. So along an orbit.
Gradient is direction of maximum increase or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Maximum change.
Maximum, exactly. So maybe I possibly got the sign wrong and it decreases, but E applies to F is like G pi J, df dxi, df dxj, and this is positive because it's the length of a vector.
Okay, I see.
So first thing, why is each face a disk? Not totally obvious. But if you think about, let's see. The reason is it has coordinates. As one coordinate given by f, and the locus where f is constant, it's constant, is a circle. Because we can always find coordinates where it looks like x1 squared plus x2 squared. So each face looks like this. The radius looks like f. And then there's this angular coordinate too. And everything flows in. Similarly, for each saddle, we build an edge. Which is the set of x and sigma, where x flows to the saddle. This is a one-dimensional manifold, because on a saddle, one direction attracts and one direction repels. And for each source, we put a vertex, which is just the source itself. So we've kind of seen how we can break it up into faces, edges, and vertices with a face for each sink, an edge for each saddle, and a vertex for each source. That tells us vertices minus edges plus faces is equal to saddles, sources plus the number of sinks minus the number. This was just a sketch, but it was reasonably convincing. the assumption that f is a gradient, you can remove that assumption, but the argument is quite a bit trickier, because if my vector field was not a gradient, then you also have to worry about periodic orbits, which can't happen if it's a gradient. So it becomes harder. Any questions about this argument?
This question may not make sense, but is there any way to generalize it into, for example, a tensor field?
Yes. There are statements like this for tensor fields, which tell you but let's think about it for a surface. If I have a tensor field, say it was a tensor field of rank 4, the tangent tensor of the tangent. And because I'm in a two-dimensional manifold, asking that that tensor field vanishes, that's 4 equations,
yes.
2 parameters.
Yes.
That's really easy. That's really strong. So that generically will not be anywhere where it vanishes. So what you want to do is look for multiple tensor fields and look for an equation where they fail to become linearly independent. So there are contexts where you can set up such an equation and the number of points or say they fail to become linearly independent, will be a topological invariant. But it's more complex.
Maybe when we have a sink or source, the derivative of phi should diverge, right? Because like, but here you assume it's zero. Like in system, dynamical system, when we have a point which is like attractor, the derivative diverges, because if I go everywhere, I see something else, right?
The derivative of?
Part is like a point charge. It's not like that?
No, I think it must be some other quantity as derivative diverges. I'm saying something really simple.
I'm like assuming F as a potential on a sphere, and the gradient becomes electrical charge, and that is related to Laplacian, which is the charge, right? This is good intuition for that. Like I'm seeing this problem as electromagnetism on a sphere.
Yes. This is how Riemann also saw it. Pretty much. In Riemann's original paper about this kind of thing. Let's see. If you had a point charge on a sphere, the one form should look like d theta or something like this. The kind of thing you're thinking about?
This diverges.
Yeah, that diverges, but that's not. I find myself a little confused. I think that what we're discussing here is really much more elementary. You know, you just take a function, you differentiate it, you view it as a vector field. And if the function vanishes order 2, then the vector field vanishes order 1. Pretty simple. But, I mean, I think you're talking about something more sophisticated.
Yeah, I think there are different pictures.
Are there any other questions?
Probably. In that picture, when we have, you assume your F to be some potential on the sphere, the place where the vector field diverges is not on the sphere. Because because that's the electric field that diverges. That's at say origin of that three-dimensional space.
Ah.
So, yeah, this is.
Okay.
I think analogy is good, but it doesn't diverge.
But also, we can change maybe this by putting the condition that f diverges and the derivative of f diverges at some point. Probably we end up at other theorem, which becomes the two-dimensional electrostatic on the sphere, right? Like if I change the condition, like instead of zero, I put delta Dirac, something like that.
Yes, okay, so you want to say that like you have a vector field which satisfies Maxwell's equations with the source at some point. So the Maxwell's equations are, and they can be written as follows. Kind of some operator called the hot star, which we haven't discussed, really just rotates things by 90 degrees. These are Maxwell's equations. And you want to say that there's a source term over here or something like that. Yeah, so then, you know, the source term was over here. Then by Stokes' theorem, the count of all the sources with sine is zero.
Yeah.